From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a surprising turn in the Kevin Spacey sexual assault case, and Saturday's arrest of billionaire Jeffrey Epstein still resonating across the country. We'll check in with our legal analyst, Nancy Gertner, to break it all down. Also today, with more than 11 shark sightings off Cape Cod this week, we check in with the state's top shark expert.
This is a natural hunting ground for this species. And take into consideration the fact that you are a land animal going in the ocean, and be vigilant.
And in the Instagram era, rethinking travel photography in sensitive places.
Oh, wow, look at me. I'm in this one location that had this really horrific event, but I'm just only going to showcase myself and my brand and not actually pay homage to the event and experience that had occurred. I think it's incredibly disrespectful.
We'll take your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're going to start today with a check-in on a number of legal issues that are resonating across both Massachusetts and the rest of the country. And who better to help us make sense of all of that than Nancy Gertner? She is a retired federal judge. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and a regular legal analyst on Radio Boston, and she joins us now. Judge Gertner, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Okay, so I want to start with a surprise development in the Kevin Spacey sexual assault case. So yesterday in Nantucket District Court, his accuser decided to invoke his own Fifth Amendment rights. There seems to be some debate over whether these relevant text messages were deleted from the accuser's phone. I'm wondering, how uncommon is it for an accuser to actually plead the Fifth in sort of their case?
It's very, very unusual. It doesn't usually happen, and it has serious consequences for the case. It's not that he was pleading the Fifth with respect to something that was peripheral or not important. He was pleading the Fifth about the cell phone, which was an important corroboration of his account of what had gone on. And if parts of the cell phone were deleted, text messages were deleted, then that undermines the defense's ability to challenge his version of what was going on. So it's not taking the Fifth about something peripheral. It's taking the Fifth about something that was pretty central.
But why does he need to take the Fifth? I mean, yes, it hurts the case, but doesn't the Fifth imply that he may have done something wrong and has a problem for himself?
There's a statute that deals with tampering with evidence. It was, in fact, the very statute that Annie Duquesne, the chemist who tampered with drug samples, was convicted and sent to prison on. So there is a statute that would apply. It was an idle threat, although I doubt very much whether anyone would have gone after him for that.
So you mentioned a minute ago that it's going to be kind of tough for the prosecution to proceed if they don't have testimony from the accuser. Why didn't the judge just dismiss the case yesterday?
Because it's a big decision for a judge to do that in a sexual assault case where that's the accusation. It's a big decision. I would imagine that the judge wanted some time, and in addition, he may have wanted to give the prosecution an opportunity to see if the prosecution could make its case without the complaining witness. And that's going to be difficult if the text that would have arguably corroborated or whatever, there were apparently photos as well that the young man was sending. If you can corroborate by evidence other than his words, the case could proceed. The problem is that evidence other than his words is precisely the evidence that was arguably tampered with. But the judge, I think, wanted time to think about what to do.
Do you think he likely will, in the end, throw it out?
If I had to predict, and I can never predict what another judge would do, I would predict that he would throw it out.
So
yes.
As far as the tampering goes, accuser's mother testified that she did, in fact, delete content of what she called frat boy activities off the phone, but she says that nothing was relevant to the case. Has she opened herself up to possible legal trouble after having done that?
She surely could, yes. But as I said, just having an arguable case against you doesn't necessarily mean that you will be prosecuted for it. But certainly she did. She opened it up. She was going to turn over the phone to the government, and then basically was going to pretty it up before she did. And so that exposes her to it. It's unlikely anyone would go after her.
Okay, so there's a risk, but it's unlikely anyone's going to follow up on that risk.
Sure.
I'm just going to ask you one more question on this case. There also was briefly a civil suit that the accuser filed against Spacey and then withdrew something like 6 days later. I wonder, first, are simultaneous criminal and civil cases common? Is that a normal thing to see? And does the withdrawal of that civil case tell us anything we should be paying attention to?
Well, it's not unusual to have civil and criminal cases at the same time. Usually a civil case is stayed because the defendant can't really answer while he's defending himself on the criminal case. But I think here was it was a greater complication here, which is, I think the civil case has discovery rules. Discovery is the ability to find out what the evidence of the other side has. And I think that the potential for finding out more about the accuser, which is in the civil case, may have given the lawyer pause because he was basically exposing the accuser before the criminal case. And so in a situation which is really a credibility battle, which is what this is, you don't want to give the other side more access to your plaintiff, to the accuser here, than you otherwise would get. So that may be one reason.
It's a different interpretation. You know, some people have said maybe there was a settlement, but given the pleading the fifth, what you're talking about does, from an outsider's perspective, seem like a more likely explanation for
removing.
Yeah. All right,
it's complicated to settle a case while there's a pending criminal case. That actually raises all sorts of ethical issues.
Well, it's going to be an interesting thing to watch over the next couple of days, unless it is superseded by this other very interesting thing to watch, which has been kind of the shocking turn of events with the indictment of billionaire Jeffrey Epstein. He was arrested on Saturday. He's facing federal sex trafficking, conspiracy, and sex trafficking charges. Just first, can you give us some legal context? What does sex trafficking mean?
Well, there's a federal statute that has to do with trafficking of minors for sexual activities. It's usually trafficking of minors for prostitution, but the statute is even broader. It could be trafficking minors for the purposes of pornography. Trafficking means transporting young women, minors, across state lines for the purposes of sex or for the purposes of child pornography. And it really is under 18, with the penalties more for under 14 and still high for 14 to 18. These are very serious offenses.
And in 2007, he pled guilty to solicitation of prostitution and procurement of minors for prostitution, which is something a little different than the sex trafficking. Some of that sounds like it has to do with age, but is state lines the other difference between sex trafficking and prostitution?
Right. And that actually is a big difference. Epstein pled guilty in state court to a state charge. What he is accused of in New York now is a federal charge of taking young women across state lines. And what we understand is that to some degree it involves different conduct in New York. It may involve different victims. It's hard to know at this point. But even if it didn't involve different victims, the fact of the matter is you can always have a federal prosecution following a state case. So that shouldn't be a bar.
So staying on the question of the charges themselves for just a second longer, the allegations involve sex with minors in both cases. Why is he not being charged with child sex abuse? These are children.
Well, there's really no federal sex abuse statute. And I suppose that the New York State authorities, had they evidence of that, could have brought those charges in New York. But here's the thing. It's complicated, and I think this complicated the decision in Florida. He paid these girls money for what they did. And that fits, while that is, in my view, child abuse in any event when you're dealing with kids this age. I think that the prosecutor may have felt it fit more appropriately with crossing state lines for prostitution. In other words, the fact of paying them money, well, it shouldn't matter for a 14-year-old. May have changed his view of what was appropriate to charge.
Well, it doesn't. It shouldn't matter. Maybe it does.
It shouldn't matter. You know, this is a question. This is a charging decision. He knew he had a charge. The prosecutor in New York knew he had a charge that would yield 10 to 15 years, 15 to life if the child, if that person is under the age of 14, 15 to life.
Okay.
So I think these were very serious charges, and he had enough to get into federal court on them.
So to that point of the seriousness of the charges, I mentioned a minute ago that he pled guilty to some other charges in 2007. That was part of a plea deal that was granted to him. So a couple of conditions of the plea deal, he and other unnamed individuals were granted federal immunity in that deal. And it also sentenced him to 13 months in a county jail. But during that time, he was allowed to leave almost every day on work release. It was even reported that he had a car and driver pick him up and take him to and from work up to 6 days a week at his office. From an outsider's perspective, that seems really lenient, is it?
It is. It is. That would depend on Florida law, whether or not some, well, two things. Sometimes with minor charges, there is a, you know, you can basically do your time on weekends with minor charges. What is interesting here is how could this possibly have been seen as a minor charge?
Yeah. Yeah.
So even given whatever the rules were in Florida state, it's actually probably county jail, one has to question why he was allowed to do that. And I think it's an open question.
And another twist on that plea deal, it was the current U.S. Labor Secretary, Alexander Acosta, who was the federal prosecutor who agreed to the deal. He has been excoriated by Democrats for his role in it, but tweeted a statement about Epstein's arrest saying, quote, "I'm pleased that New York prosecutors are moving forward with a case based on new evidence. With the evidence available more than a decade ago, federal prosecutors insisted that Epstein go to jail, register as a sex offender, and put the world on notice that he was a sexual predator." What do you make of Acosta's role in the plea deal back then?
Well, Acosta, first of all, is covering his whatever by saying this is new evidence. We don't know whether it's new evidence, right? The indictment doesn't, it's hard to map the current indictment onto what Acosta knew back in 2007, 2008.
And excuse me for interrupting, but in fact, that's particularly or specifically not clear right now, correct, Judge
right.
Gertner? Okay.
Right.
Sorry,
that
go
is
ahead.
Absolutely not clear. Surely the pornographic pictures that were found in Epstein's residence is new evidence, but that wasn't the evidence that framed this indictment. That's something they found out about in a search which they entered into, at which they conducted after they brought this indictment. So he's saying that because that's a way of covering himself up.
Okay.
The what do I make of it? It was a stunning deal. It's
okay.
A stunning deal. It was a stunning deal when it was disclosed. It really is a stunning deal. And it's a deal of no prosecution. It's not a plea bargain on the federal side. It was a deal not to prosecute after they had actually drawn up pages and pages and pages of charges. So it was an extraordinary deal.
So we have these new accusations, new charges in the arrest now. The Miami Herald published extensive pieces on Epstein prior to his arrest. You know, how big of an impact do you think investigative journalism had in the new case?
Well, the best indication of the impact of investigative journalism is what the U.S. Attorney Berman said. He, in fact, referred to the Miami Herald investigation. I don't know whether the Miami Herald investigation came up with new information or whether the Miami Herald investigation just told the narrative of the old information. It's hard to know. But it seems clear, even from what Berman said, that played a role in their going after Epstein now.
So in that instance, it did play a role. I feel like we've got a note that reporter Vicki Ward wrote a piece in 2003 on Epstein for Vanity Fair. And she says that before her piece was published, an editor removed references to allegations that Epstein had extorted and assaulted young girls, even though she had multiple girls who were willing to go on record with their allegations. It makes me wonder, is it possible that the failure to report the truth then may have delayed justice with Epstein? Was there a falling down there?
Well, it's possible. On the one hand, and let me play the professor here, it's right for a reporter to pause before you make an accusation like this, which could potentially be defamatory. There's no question about it. On the other hand, if she had credible evidence, then she should go forward with it. But these kinds of accusations are not like saying, you know, he cheated on his taxes. These are incredibly inflammatory accusations, and people, reporters, newspapers, America should pause before they make them. Pausing doesn't mean you don't do it if you have the evidence, but the pause, I understand. I can't say whether if it came out in 2003, it would have affected 2008, because the allegations in 2008 were extraordinary, mm-hmm. and that was still enough to lead to this non-prosecution agreement.
No, that's a fair point. All right, so just to shift gears one more time, he has been connected, Epstein has, to a number of high-profile individuals. Attorney Alan Dershowitz, who's been a guest on this show, worked on Epstein's defense team in 2007 and has actually been accused of having sex with an underage girl at Epstein's Palm Beach mansion, allegations which he denies. Epstein has also been connected socially to Presidents Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. What do you make of the network of powerful, influential people that Epstein has associated with, and how do you think that affects what you'll be watching for as this case moves forward?
It's hard to know. His web of affiliations was quite substantial. And so, again, on the one hand, you don't want, there may be lots of men who are very nervous tonight. Now, should they be nervous? There's a difference between, there's a certain amount of guilt by association that is going on here, which of course is troubling, right? If you flew in his plane, it didn't necessarily mean you did the kinds of things that he was accused of doing. On the other hand, he was known for this, apparently, if you just listen to what the president said about what he knew, right? He liked beautiful women, he liked beautiful girls. They were a little on the young side. So there may be many men who are nervous tonight.
Yeah, yeah. So to that subject of men who have been made nervous by cases in the last couple of years, we're going to continue to follow the Epstein story at WBUR, including questions of his sizable donations to Harvard here in our community. But in the meantime, it's been nearly 2 years since the assault allegations against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein that launched the Me Too movement. What is that legacy in your mind as we see another rich, powerful man being accused of years of serial sexual abuse?
But what it suggests to me is the impunity that Epstein felt, notwithstanding the Me Too movement, notwithstanding these high-profile accusations, and notwithstanding having become so close to substantial federal time in 2008, Epstein felt that he had impunity to continue if these allegations are true. That is extraordinary. That either is a function of his power and powerful friends, or it's a function of the impunity, frankly, that for want of a better word, a white privileged man continues to feel. We saw some of it in the Weinstein accusations. This was going on for years, if the accounts are true, you know, supported by lots and lots of people. So it says something about how deep these feelings, this impunity goes, this sense that I can't be touched, either because I have money or because I'm a man.
Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks for being with us again today.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This morning, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy put out some really interesting drone footage of an interaction between two great white sharks off the coast of Chatham yesterday. Joining us now on the line to discuss what the footage shows and what it means is Greg Skomel, senior scientist at the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. He is the shark guy here in Massachusetts. Greg Skomel, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
So I saw this footage. Describe it to our listeners. What does it actually show?
Well, you know, I'll preface it by saying that, you know, for the last 10 years, we've been looking at white sharks off Cape Cod, and we've been seeing all kinds of scarring and wound patterns that could only be attributed to other white sharks. But we've never seen any kind of interaction between white sharks directly, no direct observations. And so this particular footage, which shows, you know, a white shark moving through shallow waters and then another one quickly approaching it and seemingly trying to grab onto it, and then the original white shark kind of twisting away and taking off, is quite intriguing to us because we've never seen these kinds of social interactions before.
So what
it all means, I don't know.
When I first saw it, my first reaction was that it reminded me of watching a baby elephant play with a mama elephant. It seemed playful. Now, I know you've never seen sharks interact socially like that before, but is there any reason to believe there could be playful activity between this, like, the scariest thing in the ocean?
No, I honestly don't. I mean, it's never been documented in these fish, that kind of activity. There tends to be, when it comes to social behavior between sharks, you know, there tends to be a territoriality that might be protection of one's own space. There could be defensive posturing. There could be aggressive interactions. And there could be behavior that would be indicative of courtship or mating. And that's pretty much it. And so it's likely one of the above, and as we analyze this video even further, I'm hoping we could tease out perhaps a little bit more about its behavior.
So there is an app called Sharktivity, and it tracks shark sightings, and there have been some 40 sightings off the coast of the Cape in the last week. You've been out there tagging sharks. What do we know about what's bringing these sharks to the waters off the Cape?
Well, it's a phenomenon we've been looking at for the last decade, and basically as we have very effectively restored seal populations to fairly high levels, it's only quite natural that the biomass of seals is going to attract their natural predator, and those predators are white sharks. And so as the seals are piled up all along Massachusetts coastline, even into the Gulf of Maine and Canada, these white sharks will approach these areas in order to attempt to feed on them. So it's a very natural predator-prey relationship that we have essentially reestablished with the restoration of seals.
So, Greg Skomel, first, I want to apologize to listeners because I may not have made it clear in the way that I phrased my question that the app, the Sharktivity app, is actually your app. You developed it. I want to stay on this question of the seals. The number that I've read is something like 50,000 seals in southern Massachusetts, which, A, is that as huge a number as it sounds like? And B, is climate change impacting the number of seals that are coming and how far north we're seeing sharks travel to get to them?
Well, these are great questions. I think the most current published estimate has roughly 30 to 50,000 seals, which is a big number. But we have to think of these seals as being part of a much bigger population that extends throughout the entire northeastern part of the United States and Canada. So this is kind of the southern limit of their distribution. And there's roughly thought to be about 500,000 gray seals in that area. And so with the white sharks, now a lot of people think this is a relatively new phenomenon that white sharks are coming into these northern waters, but it's been well established through historical accounts that white sharks have traveled into the Gulf of Maine, up to Canada, and are well established in this region on a seasonal basis.
Even recently?
Yeah, absolutely. So what's changing is with the high densities of seals in certain areas, we're creating the aggregating behavior of white sharks. In other words, they're moving into shallow areas in bigger numbers, like we would move to a restaurant, aggregate at a restaurant, a good eatery. And that's exactly what these sharks are doing. So it seemingly looks like, wow, a complete redistribution. And in some ways, it's a redistribution just in response to the potential for foraging.
So I just want to follow this a little more to make sure I'm understanding you, because you know, I think you're saying that the sharks are changing behavior in response to food. Am I understanding too that the supply of food is changing in its kind of volume? And if that's the case, is there a climate dimension to that or not? I just want to make sure I'm understanding you.
Well, the volume of food, namely the number of seals, is changing because of the very strict conservation we put in place in 1972.
So it's really public policy that's driving this.
it's public policy. We tend to want to link things to climate change. At this stage, there's no linkage between the restoration of seals, the restoration of sharks, or the distribution of these two animals. Now, how that changes in the next decade will be very interesting to watch.
That's really helpful clarification. So I want to ask you then, what do you make of some of the calls on the Cape to cull the seal population?
Well, I think it's somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction. We tend to want quick fixes to perceived problems. I mean, there are opinions on the Cape ranging from this is a beautiful natural restoration of an ecosystem to this is, you know, a nightmare. And so we get this range of attitudes, and as a result, you get folks who want to leave it all alone, and you get people who want to remove and restore things to what they were when we had wiped out seal populations. Unfortunately, I think the removal of the seals is, number one, in gross violation of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and would take an act of Congress. And also, you know, it's not particularly feasible because we have to think in terms of the size of this population, not as being 40 or 50,000 seals, but as being half a million. That are always moving.
Yeah. So that's really helpful perspective. And it means that the sharks, as I understand it, are here. The seals are here. Coexistence is where we are and where we're going to be. On a very serious note, last summer we saw just a tragic death of a 26-year-old man, Arthur Medici, who was killed in the state's first fatal shark attack since 1936. So under the circumstances, what is your message to boaters, swimmers, others who are out there for the summer?
Well, it was a tragic event, and we've been seeing more of these negative interactions between white sharks and people over the course of the last 6 or 7 years, and of course, culminating in the death of Arthur. And it is tragic, and the Cape is trying to come to terms with it. We're trying to come to terms with it. My immediate solution to this, and there is no silver bullet solution at this stage, but my immediate instinct is, I know that in the short term, I can't control the behavior of the sharks, which are the predators, or the prey, the seals, but I can control my behavior. So I'm encouraging people to, if you're in areas where there are high densities of seals, where this predator-prey relationship is playing out every day, take that into consideration when it comes to your activities in the water.
What does that look like? Don't expose yourself okay, go ahead.
To undue risk. You know, I would suggest staying close to shore. I wouldn't put yourself in water that's much over your waist, particularly if there's high densities of seals in the area. These sharks are hunting, and they're hunting in very shallow water, and that water can be very close to shore. So if you're concerned about the risk, and remember, the risk is quite low. I mean, the probability of a shark attack is still a really, really low probability. But if that concerns you, then, you know, stay close to the beach and stay in shallow water.
So, Greg, in our last 20 seconds or so, if someone were to be unfortunate enough to be attacked, or if a shark is near a person, what do you do?
Well, obviously, if the shark's biting you, you want to strike the shark as any way you can to discourage it and force it to let go, and it will let go. But if the shark is just circling or close, just remove yourself from the water. Put yourself at safety.
That makes really good common sense, I have to say. Greg Skomel is a senior scientist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Oh, real pleasure. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up in the Instagram era, rethinking travel photography in sensitive places. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Listeners, Where are you traveling this summer? Do your plans include sites like a Civil War battlefield of Gettysburg or the memorial for the victims of 9/11 at the World Trade Center in New York? Are you among those going abroad to see maybe the beaches of Normandy where the Allies began the big push against the Nazis? As you prepare for a trip like that, are you thinking about what is appropriate, what is an appropriate way to visit places that are laden with painful, tragic, but important histories? And how do you photograph that while you're there? That's our conversation for today. And joining me now to have it is Shira Springer. She's WBUR Sports and Society reporter. Shira has also written for Let's Go Europe, a budget travel guide, and wrote and took travel photography for the Boston Globe's travel section. Hello, Shira.
Hello.
And also with us is Brenda Nguyen. She runs Wandering Boston Eater, a travel and food Instagram. Brenda, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hello. Listeners, hello. Listeners, we want to hear from you. We want to know what you think. What do you think about when you're documenting a sensitive place? How do you think Instagram has changed travel in general or your travel? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. We're really looking forward to hearing from you. So let me set this up. There was a story recently about backlash to how some people had photographed the city of Pripyat, Ukraine, which was devastated by the Chernobyl nuclear accident. Now, after the backlash calmed down, it became clear that some of the photos that seemed maybe offensive had actually been more appropriate and thoughtful than it first seemed. But it really got us thinking about how you photograph sensitive areas in a time when everyone can and does take photos. So, Brenda, I'm going to start with you. You travel a lot around the world. How has Instagram changed the way we engage with travel and the places that we travel to?
Yes, this is a great question. So with Instagram, I think it's really heightened that people just want to show. They just want to show what they've done. They want to, you know, show their accomplishments. And it's almost like, here is the unicorn effect. Like, I have gone somewhere really spectacular. Look at me do this. And then it just keeps on increasing. It's like, okay, well, not only am I there, like, let's see how I look like here. Or if I look like, you know, a certain way here, let me highlight that not only am I here, but how can I also one up the other person who is already here too? Because on top of that, Instagram culture has that competitive nature of that horrendous like button. Mm-hmm. So the more likes you get, then that, you know, equates to that instant gratification feeling of reward of you being somewhere spectacular. So suddenly it's the motivation is shifting between the mentality behind why are you posting on Instagram as well as why are you even traveling? So how do those two thoughts coincide with one another?
So Shira, what do you think about this idea that we change how we document our travel because we find ourselves kind of in a competitive environment while doing it?
I think it can be dangerous, quite frankly, when you have that competitive mindset and you're going to a place like I did, like Auschwitz, which is a concentration camp. I've been to several concentration camps for really personal reasons because I come from a family with Holocaust survivors and I've gone to the camps where they were imprisoned. And I think you have to be very careful about recognizing the difference between saying I am here and how do I look here and documenting that, and then also having a reflective and personal experience. I think there's room for both, but I think you have to make sure when you are going to a sensitive site where there might be, you know, if it's not your personal history that's there, somebody else's personal history is a very somber personal history. You have to be cognizant of that and perhaps push pause on the competitive nature of, you know, being on Instagram.
So Ron from New Hampshire is called in. Ron, what's on your mind?
Sure. I travel battlefields all over the world. It's kind of a hobby of mine. And I think you have to approach these places with a real appreciation for the human struggle that's occurred in these locations. So doing a selfie for the sake of proving you've been there, I think is very inappropriate. But if you're capturing the scene, trying to explore the intensity of the human experience of that site and sharing that in social media, that's a whole nother thing. And I just think that these sites are tragic locations as well as heroic at times. And I think if you can share that, it's, you know, it, as opposed to just proving you're there is a you're doing a service as opposed to doing damage to the area.
Ron, thanks so much for that call. And listeners, join Ron's voice. Let's hear what you think, too. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Shira, were you about to respond to Ron?
I totally appreciate what Ron is saying. And I think, you know, you can have an experience. You can take the photographs and you can share it in a way that's educational and informative and makes, you know, your experience something that tells other people, you know, who might not get to go to these battlefields or to Auschwitz or wherever you're going, that's a sensitive site. You know, it can be a little bit instructional. But it goes back to what I was saying a little bit before, which is the proper mindset. You know, you can't go to these places with the mindset of this is my moment. I'm going to take a selfie here. I'm here. I want to show everybody I'm here. You have to go with the proper mindset. And I will say this, at Auschwitz, there are places where you cannot take photographs. There are what I would call in some ways sacred spaces that are just, you know, either the memories there are too painful or what happened there is really too tragic. And you can't do it. And they police that. And I think something else we might want to get into, which is it is incumbent, I think, on some of the places that we visit to start putting limits on where we can take some travel photography.
So, Brenda, there's a lot in what Shira just said and what the caller Ron said. One of the dynamics that seems to be at play is the difference between sort of experiencing the site and being of service to yourself or others and understanding the history of the site. And what I think is an understandable desire to say, I was here. I want to remember this for myself. And it does seem like in the age of Instagram, your family photo album is your Instagram. So how do we manage this balance between wanting to be respectful of the site, but the understandable desire to document, hey, I was here. I did this. This was me.
So I think that then comes down to, again, what are the intentions ultimately when you are taking those photos? So, you know, if it is a family trip, for example, and everything too, is the takeaway that a family would like to have be, hey, we went to this really tragic site, let's all document this, that we were here? Because that is also of the same mentality. So it's when we're with social media, we have a choice. We have a choice to be able to utilize that power of sharing, that power of knowledge and being able to educate people and share knowledge that they would have never had access to before. So for those who are looking to utilize, you know, social media, Instagram as a platform, as their photo album, to continue to document their experiences, I think it's really important that, you know, to echo that we are using it to educate, we are using it to talk about this is how we respect the location. This is how we respect what has happened and what has occurred at these establishments, because it isn't about us. It isn't about, you know, what our experiences are now to get there, but it is about the experience that we're recognizing and reflecting on what has already happened.
This is a fascinating conversation. Let's bring some more listeners into it. Mary from Winchester, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I was at the Berlin Holocaust Memorial a year and a half ago, and it was beautiful, and I did take pictures just to show the immensity and intensity and how moving it was. But what bothered me were two young women that were lounging on one of the blocks with a selfie stick taking pictures, and I really felt they were oblivious to where they were and what it meant. They do have people in Berlin that go around and tell people to stop doing that, which is important. But I think people are so more into making the picture look good, they don't even realize the whole emotional aspect of where they are.
So maybe insensitive to their environment or just not taking in the gravity of their environment.
Correct.
Mary, thanks so much for that call. Let's also talk to Yolanta from Hollis, New Hampshire. Yolanta, tell us what's on your mind.
You know, I think it's very important to also lead by example as a parent. I have two kids, 12 and 14, and whenever we go, wherever we go, I tell them that it's very important to experience the place for what it is and not for the sake of posting pictures and then hoping for likes, because that really diminishes the actual experience and makes it kind of very superficial. So just to give an example, they have smartphones because of the peer pressure, and I have strict limits on how how much they use it. They use their smartphones. I have a flip phone to the horror, of course, but I bring a camera and I take pictures, and I do tell them that it is to memorialize our moments together, and not to post it in the hope of getting likes, some kind of a following,
yep.
Which unfortunately is kind of a very prevalent attitude among especially young people.
Thank you for that, Yolanta. And that is so consistent with what Brenda was saying about it's not about you. It's, you know, in service to the site. I appreciate your call. Listeners, you are important to this conversation. So keep calling in 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Shira, you were nodding all over the place during those
two calls.
Well,
it's not all over the place. And also, I'm you know, one of the things I'm curious about is I think Brenda may be somewhat the exception to the rule in the respect that, you know, saying it's not about us, because if you do look at some of the pictures, many of the pictures, quite frankly, that you see on Instagram, it does seem like it's often about us.
Well, so Brenda, to Shira's point, it does seem to be a self-focused platform.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you think about it, so there's on Instagram, there's so many niches of the type of microbloggers that are out there. There are food bloggers, there are travel bloggers, there are lifestyle bloggers. So specifically, let's take a look at travel bloggers. And if you take a look at the travel bloggers that are well-known or have a high following count, what you find in their photos is that they are those people who are just taking photos of themselves at a site. They hire photographers to take photos of themselves at a location. And I think that that doesn't tell a story at all. That what that shows is, here's a pretty photo of me, take a look at it. Wow, I'm going to edit the photo to make this aesthetically pleasing to my palette and my eye. But that's the extent of it. And that's there isn't any depth to it, unfortunately. So it's really important to take a step back. And it's like, why are we, and just continue to question, why are we doing this? What is the purpose? Because I think it really comes down to wanting to be, going back again to that competitive nature, wanting to just one up the person next to you. Because what social media has really done is driven that unicorn effect, that somebody out there has something better than me, and I want that, and I want to show that I got that too. And it's not about that.
Go ahead, Shira.
I was just saying, I think it comes down to then a question of who polices that competitiveness, right? You know, who makes sure it doesn't become this crazy selfie taking at, I think it was Mary who brought up the selfie taking at the Berlin Holocaust Memorial. And if I'm thinking it's of the one that I recall from Berlin, it's right near the Tiergarten, not far from the Brandenburg Gate, right in the middle of a cluster of a lot of tourist attractions where it might be more appropriate to do that selfie taking. So I'm glad to hear that there was someone there who was saying, hey, this is not appropriate for this space. But, you know, I think we're reaching a point where we have to start thinking about who does that policing? Is it somebody at the museums, at the concentration camps, at the memorial sites? I mean, do they have to be more vigilant about that? And I think we're heading to a point where that is the case.
So in this vigilance, there's an aspect of arbitration to that, or being the arbiter. And one is the arbiter of where is it an appropriate place. But also I wonder, and this is to either of you, about the arbitration about when is the historical site so far in the past? So, for example, offensive potentially to take a selfie at that memorial in Berlin from the 1940s, but not seemingly offensive to take a picture in the Colosseum from 2,000 years ago, maybe to take a selfie, where we know people were slaughtered and had to kill each other and were sacrificed to wild animals. So how do we decide, to use your term, Shira, the sacredness of the site? And Brenda, I'll turn to you first.
Yeah, I don't think that we are the ones that get to decide. It should be those of that culture, the people who are living and breathing in that area in that moment, they are the ones that get to decide, because this is their reality every single day. So it really comes down to, how do we respect the cultures? How do we respect the people? And how do we step out of our own selfishness to make sure that we are able to be cognizant of other people's experiences before we start thinking about our own? Because, again, what is the reason that we're going out there? These are living, breathing people who are still, you know, experiencing those establishments every single day. If we find that they have moved on, then at that point, and they're opening their world, their culture to other people to explore, that is when we should understand and parallel those actions.
So, Shira, I know you want to weigh in. Be fast because the lines are full.
I was going to say, and I think that's what's happening. I mean, in Berlin, it was clearly somebody of the city who was, you know, who was either an official with the Berlin Holocaust Memorial or somebody, a citizen of Berlin. And the same thing from what I saw at Auschwitz, which was it was people who were working there who were policing.
So
that's
again,
that's working. What Brenda's suggesting is happening and it's
working. Excellent. All right. So let's add Raymond from Providence to the conversation. Raymond, share your thoughts with us.
How are you?
Well, thanks. Go ahead.
Great. Thanks so much. In December of 2017, I went to South America and ended my trip in Santiago, Chile. And I was really excited to go to the Museum of Memory and Human Rights, which commemorated and told the story of the brutal Pinochet dictatorship, which our own CIA helped was complicit in. And I ended up taking photos and posting it on Instagram just of the museum itself, and ended up using the caption section as an opportunity to really tell the story of how dictatorships come to be and what maybe some of the parallels that were going on in our own country. And I ended up missing my flight, and so I ended up having a full extra day in in Santiago. And I, unbeknownst to me, that extra day I got was the day of the presidential election, where Piñera, who is the conservative candidate, ended up winning. And I ended up not posting about that because, as your guest, I think, really has been beautifully saying, I am a guest there. Mm-hmm. And I travel. I love that question of why are you traveling? Not only why are you posting, but why are you traveling? And so I am a guest there. And so for me, it's really important to kind of honor that kind of temporary space and take those experiences back with me. Not for selfish reasons.
Raymond, thanks so much for that contribution. That's great. I'm going to take in another caller. I'm not sure I'm going to get this name right, but I'm going to try. Adwit from Waltham. How'd I do?
Oh, you did pretty close.
All right.
Add and then wait.
Add, wait. So
thanks for taking my call.
Yes, and tell me what's on your mind.
So one of the things I was listening into was people take pictures and, post information on social media. I have been to the Holocaust Museum and some other places. I feel the right thing to do is just do a check-in, which, you know, tells people that you have been there, but it's not about you. It's about the place more so than about you. So that's the kind of feeling I thought would be right, but, you know, is that right is something I would like to bring to the table.
Thanks so much for that. I'm going to add one more voice. We've got Shuri from Watertown. Tell us what's on your mind.
Hi, it's actually Sherry and Tiziana. We know each other from another context. Hello.
Hello. Shuri. Hey, how are you?
Yes. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Well, thanks. Go ahead.
Great. So real quickly, I had a couple of experiences that this conversation reminds me of. One, attending or visiting a site in Ghana that was where a number of slaves were funneled into ships. And another was going to a concentration camp in Germany. And for both of those, I was either a teenager or a young adult, and it was pre-Instagram days. But the thing that made the difference for me, you know, going from kind of a giddy tourist, not really that conscious about what this field trip was that I was going on, to actually having a really meaningful, powerful experience was the people who were taking us on the tours. And in the case when I was a teenager, there was a teacher that was leading the group, and on the bus, he basically stopped all the conversation when he heard all of us getting kind of silly and crazy on the bus, and he kind of put the reality to
gave
it.
Me some perspective.
That, listen, this is a somber. This is a somber experience.
Sherry, so, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we've got just a couple minutes left, and I want to give our guests an opportunity to react to what you just said. Shira, go ahead.
I think the caller brings up a really good point in that it is the place that you're going that helps set the tone, and the teachers, the chaperones. You know, what was interesting, and I'll just relate to my experience at Auschwitz, was it's a tourist site. I believe when I went, it was the number one ranked tourist site in Poland. There were tons of tour buses out there in the parking lot.
You shared some photographs of
exactly,
tour buses.
Exactly.
They're on radioboston.org.
Yes, and there were tour buses, there were school groups, and I think, again, you know, this goes back to a little bit about what Brenda says, and, you know, taking your cues from the people around you. All of this matters. The people who are the custodians of the site, whether they're locals or whether they're security or whether they're tour guides, and quite frankly, whether they're teachers who are functioning as chaperones on school trips, it's part of their responsibility now to set that tone, to in some ways make sure that the intentions are right and that people understand the sacredness of these places. I mean, I don't know how else to put it, but you know, these are distinct from other tourist attractions, and that message has to be communicated clearly to, I think, the Instagram generation.
So, Brenda, just one last comment from you about how to be a thoughtful, respectful traveler and yet do amazing work on Instagram like you do with your Instagram account.
Yeah, so I'd like to actually highlight, you know, one of the callers, Raymond, where he was stating that he wanted to actually utilize his comment, his caption section to be able to educate and discuss and comment. And I think that that is actually a really great vehicle, a really great tool to not only make sure that the photo does highlight the actual establishment, but also then the caption reflects that too.
That's Brenda Nguyen. She runs Wandering Boston Eater, a travel food and food Instagram. Brenda, thank you.
Thank you.
And Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter and a former travel writer. Thanks for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.